Okay, today we return to our series titled Unnatural Relations. These are words taken, as you will remember, from Romans 1 and referring to homosexuality. We will stay with this subject uninterrupted for the next 6 weeks. And even though we will cover a lot during this time, I should point out that even after 6 more weeks, we still won't be quite finished with this subject. We'll be close, but not finished. We began this series with addressing the questions of what is a marriage and what is a family. We spent 2 weeks looking at the biblical material and saw that God has provided us with objective, concrete definitions to those questions. And this is certainly where the battle is raging today. Our culture, as you know, is attempting to redefine these sacred institutions that God has established, and this to a large degree so that all sorts of promiscuity could be legitimized. Addressing this at the beginning of the series seemed to be an appropriate way to set things up. And so again, if you missed either of those sermons, I would just encourage you to go to our website and get caught up, as they are foundational to much of what we will be covering in the coming weeks. Another question I was eager to put toward the beginning of the series, which also is quite foundational to the whole discussion, is what causes homosexuality? Are people really born this way, as is claimed by many today, or is it the result of external conditions, as perhaps in the environment of one's home, for instance, or is it something that individuals just deliberately choose to pursue? And along that line, can it be prevented? Can it be cured? Also related would be the question, there are those who live heterosexual lives who nonetheless struggle from time to time with same-sex attraction. Are they actually homosexuals? Are they living a lie? Well, as you can see, answering these questions is a rather ambitious undertaking, and so the tricky part for me in this has been trying to decide how far to go with all of this and how to, you know, organize the material and present it. And another tricky part is that I'm relatively new to the material myself. I've been preparing for this series for over a year and reading books along the way and have learned quite a bit, which I'm eager to share. But at the same time, this is not an area of expertise for me. During the 12 years that I have been here, I have never once been faced with an occasion to offer counseling to anyone struggling with homosexuality or ever faced with the need to confront someone involved in such behavior. And except for what is going on in the cultural war itself on this issue, I'm pretty much isolated from it. I don't have any friends or family members or next-door neighbors who claim to be gay. All that to say that I will be relying on the experts, especially for today and next week. As a point of interest, Tom Detmer and I chatted a little bit before he left for Lithuania, and in that brief conversation, he assured me that the conclusions I had come to were on solid ground, at least the ones I had time to talk to him about. And I have extended to him an invitation to come and clean up anything that might need to be corrected or better explained. And so he might take me up on that in a week or two, and I'll make the same offer to Drew as well. There are two reasons I wanted to tackle these questions early in this series. One, of course, is because having a better understanding of the nature of homosexuality itself will be instrumental to the rest of the material that I plan to cover, and this will become evident in the weeks to come. The other is because I am quite eager here at the beginning to set the right emotional tone for what lies ahead. All right, let me explain this. Soon we will be looking at various passages in the Bible that condemn homosexual behavior. And we will also critique and refute the gay agenda as found in both the secular culture and even in the church itself, including evangelical churches. Basically, in the weeks to come, we're going to be grabbing our spears and marching into battle, confronting the wickedness of this movement that is threatening our civilization. We have some topics coming up here where there will be this temptation, and more or less a pretty real temptation, to feel a certain hostility toward homosexuals. And to help season some of that, to help, you know, keep the voltage down a little bit, It would serve us well to better appreciate some of the underlying factors that contribute to one's sexual orientation. In other words, some sympathy would be in order. Quite frankly, if you don't struggle with same-sex desires, then fall on your knees and thank God. In my study, I've come to better appreciate the internal conflict that people who struggle with this face. Everything that we will be getting into in the coming weeks needs to be tempered with some mercy and compassion for those who experience feelings they did not ask for, did not want, at least originally, and in many cases, wish they could get rid of. This is not to justify homosexual behavior itself or to in any way minimize the sin and offensiveness of perverted acts, but it is to point out that the temptations and desires and feelings themselves are very real. And reasons some people have these temptations and desires and feelings are because of factors outside their own control or choosing. Now, we may find, for instance, a lesbian activist protesting outside Chick-fil-A to be quite upsetting. But what we may not know is that she never formed a natural attraction toward men because her stepfather raped her over and over when she was a little girl. This is the sort of thing we need to appreciate here at the beginning of the series before we start swinging our swords, so to speak, in the weeks to come. Now, this might be a good time to review something I covered the first Sunday of this series in the introduction, and that would be definition of terms, because this will come up today, certainly, and next week. Understanding correctly what I mean when I use certain words will be critical for what we're going to be talking about. When I use the word homosexuality, I'll be using it according to the standard dictionary definition, sexual desire or sexual behavior directed toward a person of one's own sex. When using it to refer to desires, we should think of it as morally neutral. It is not a sin to have homosexual desires. On the other hand, when using it to refer to behavior or actions, we should think of it as something that God has specifically prohibited and is condemned as sin by Him. The word homosexual is a word that I myself specifically reserve for those who actually engage in forbidden behavior. That may involve actual sexual encounters or a non-sexual romantic relationship, or it could include gratification through homosexual pornography or even fixation of lustful fantasies. But the emphasis here is not on the same-sex attraction itself or the desires. It specifically involves the yielding to those attractions and desires because they are somehow played out in some fashion. Or to put it in biblical language, they have gone from the stage of temptation to that of actual sin. Now, it's not uncommon for textbooks to use the term homosexual to refer to any person with a same-sex orientation, whether they act on it or not. And this is something I ran into all the time, even in Christian literature. But because the Bible condemns the offense itself and not the temptations or desires, I prefer to reserve the word, especially for this series, for those who actually yield to those temptations and desires. So just to give you the heads up, I'm not going to refer to someone as a homosexual unless they are actually involved in behavior that is prohibited by God's word. Now, because this is such an important distinction and one that is often not clear but yet crucial to the series, let me take a moment to illustrate it again. And the last time I illustrated this, I used the analogy of stealing. Today, let me just switch it up a little bit and use one of lying. A liar is not a liar if the thought occurs to him to cheat on his tax return, or if he has a desire to cheat. He becomes a liar the moment he deliberately enters the false amount on the form. And this distinction needs to be clear, and it, when it comes to homosexuality, we need to be very clear about that, and especially for a Christian, this is a critical thing to keep straight. All right, the word gay, quickly here, is often used as a euphemism for homosexuality, and the two words have become virtually synonymous, and because it is shorter and easier to say and sounds more positive, it has become the more popular word to use. However, in the earlier days, gay originally referred to someone who had come out of the closet, who was no longer hiding their homosexuality, and so in this series, I will use that word in that context. I'll save it for that. As in referring to things like a gay rights agenda, something out in the open, or the pro-gay gospel, or gays who march in a gay pride parade, that kind of thing. Basically, gays are homosexuals who aren't ashamed of it. Therefore, all gays are homosexual, but not all homosexuals are gay. For today and next week, the focus will not be on gays or the gay movement or even homosexuals, those who yield to sinful behavior. That's all coming up in the weeks to come. Rather, the focus for now is on same-sex attraction itself. What causes it? Can it be prevented? Can it be cured? And again, I'm hoping to generate a little compassion and sympathy for those who struggle with this. You know, it's one thing to despise gay activists. They actually make it easy for us to dislike and detest them. And it's also easy to despise those homosexuals who may not be on the front lines, but who engage in their sinful behavior with each other privately. At some point in the series, we're going to talk about what our attitude toward them should be on these sorts of things. But tragically, this is the point for today, we also find ourselves having a certain contempt for those who are not involved in any such behavior at all, but yet struggle with the temptation to do so. You know, to their credit, they restrain themselves, but yet the feelings they experience are real. Nonetheless, we view them as sick, deranged, perverted, and we keep our distance. And people who struggle with this would be extremely reluctant to share their struggles with even their closest of Christian friends because this would be the expected response, right? Am I alone in saying that? Of course it would be. I mean, think of your closest Christian friend, what would your reaction be if they confided with you that they struggled with this? You would be very nervous about that. All right, so in some way, this accusation that is often hurled at us that we are driven by fear and ignorance is actually at times somewhat true. All right, so let's get to it. Theories of origin. What causes homosexual desires? The Bible doesn't provide a direct answer to the question, but it does provide the ultimate answer, and we call it the fall. All theories and explanations of homosexuality must take into account this particular tragedy when explaining how and why we experience desires God never meant for us to have. Whatever else may have gone wrong, family dynamics, early trauma, genes, hormones, negative spiritual influences, molestation, poor choices, at the root of it all is the ugly mystery of the fallen nature. We are created by God, but clearly we are not all God created us to be. And though the fall is the ultimate explanation, it still is helpful to look at specific factors in a person's life that contribute to these desires, because in many cases, as we will see, these factors could have been minimized or perhaps even eliminated. The first explanation I want to address is the one that is on the forefront of the debate today. The technical term for this is biological causation. And it's my understanding that Lady Gaga has a song out that promotes this position titled Born This Way. There has been a fair amount of research on this theory, exploring everything from brain structure to the possibility of what is called a gay gene. And are some people, one way or another, genetically predisposed toward homosexuality? That's the big question. At this point, the best we can say is that nothing is conclusive. There is no hard proof one way or the other. A responsible Christian will actually give a fair hearing to current research on this question. And who knows? It may be proven that there are inborn elements which contribute or perhaps even cause homosexual desires. And if that proves to be the case, then we'll need to accept that. But even so, it doesn't follow that this then legitimizes homosexual behavior. And this is where the point of the contention actually lies. And so let me spend a couple minutes here on this. Being born with an inherent desire towards something doesn't mean that one is somehow permitted or even obligated to fulfill that desire. When I was 7 years old, I was at a friend's house and coveted his pocket knife that he had just showed me. And when he wasn't looking, I took it off the top of his dresser and I put it in my pocket. Okay, where did this desire to covet and steal come from? I mean, I'm talking about the actual desire itself. This inward pull, this, I want that, and I want to take it even though it doesn't belong to me. Why would I ever feel anything like that at all? Where did it come from? Well, you know the answer. It's pretty clear. I was born that way. I was born with a sin gene, if you will, an indwelling drive to covet and steal and lie and cheat and disobey my parents and treat others unlovingly and be greedy and selfish and indulge my appetites without restraint. We call it the sinful nature. Again, it can be traced back to the fall. I didn't ask for these desires. It all came with the package. Just like I didn't ask to be named Wendell. That too came with the package. And I'll blame the fall for that as well. Clouded the better judgment of my parents at that time. Just because I was born this way and have these desires doesn't mean that they are morally justified and that I must act on them to be true to myself. Being willing to concede that some people may be genetically predisposed toward homosexual desires, though again that has not been proven, is still a completely different argument than I was born a homosexual. Completely different argument altogether. You will remember from the Genesis, you will remember from the previous weeks the passages in Genesis and quoted by Jesus that God has made us male and female, one or the other. We are created biologically, physically, by God as heterosexuals, everyone. So I want you to think about it. What would the physical characteristics be of someone who is actually born to be a homosexual? Think of God's design that we talked about a few weeks ago about all this and how the complementarity that God had intended here. And I don't want to be gross here, but how could someone be born with male body parts that, in a sexual act, would complement the male body parts of another? And the same could be asked of female body parts, not to mention the obvious inability to reproduce. And while it may be the case that there are inborn elements that might contribute or even cause homosexual desires, it is still a big jump from the acceptance of that to the conclusion that one is born to be a homosexual. Because our sexuality is mental, it's emotional, and it is physical. The other issue here, of course, is that the gay movement is fortifying their arguments for special rights under this banner that they are born this way, in the same way a person is born with a disability or a particular skin color. And we'll get into all that, but not today, later on in this series, because that's a whole big subject that we'll want to look at. So the bottom line here is basically this. The verdict is out on the question. And because of the biases and agendas on both sides, we should be skeptical of the research that comes out claiming anything one way or the other. If at some point, years from now, it is proven that homosexuality is inborn, at least in some, such proof would not contradict or diminish the biblical position. The biblical position is that God determines what is right and what is wrong. And because of the fall, we all have a propensity toward doing what is wrong. And yet we are responsible to exercise self-control and not do what is wrong. And so even if there is a genetically predisposition toward homosexuality, this does nothing to normalize nor legitimize homosexual behavior itself. The second explanation we want to look at this morning is often called the childhood development theory. Though the born this way theory is driving the discussion in pop culture today, the developmental theory continues to be the bedrock explanation for why certain people experience these desires. The primary focus is on the deep disturbances in the parent-child relationship, going back even to the first few years of life. And in explaining this, I'm going to be borrowing heavily from Mike Haley, who summarizes the classical explanation of the developmental theory in one of his books. And Haley has held top positions at Focus on the Family and at Exodus International and was once himself a practicing homosexual. And what he offers here pertains to males, though some of the elements could apply to females. Between the ages of 18 months and 5 years, a young child's perception of his sexual identity will come from the primary people in his life. That would be his parents. Boys, in particular, will want to reach out to their dads to connect with them. This process logically leads to healthy gender identity. That is, if the boy's interaction with his father is what it should be. And here is one of the areas where things can go haywire, even at a very, very young age. All right, so as an infant, the son had a unique bond with his mother. We all know that. But after about 18 months, he begins to recognize the similarities he has with his dad. And he now enters this transitional stage seeking to connect with him. If the father is warm and receptive, interacts positively with the young child, then this transition follows its natural course. As the child matures and grows, he continues to connect with his dad, fulfilling his natural masculine strivings and in turn securing a healthy sense of sexual identity. But if the father is cold, distant, disinterested, critical, or rejecting, at least according to the boy's perception, the boy will experience hurt and, more significantly, feel rejection, feel rejected. This hurt and rejection, if it continues, leads a young boy to detach himself from what he views as the futility of trying to form a masculine bond with his dad. He may also try to detach himself from the pain associated with the rejection he feels from his dad as well. These experiences can often lead to further problems when the boy reaches the next stage of masculine development, identification with other boys. If he lacks confidence as a male, his relationships with other boys will seem foreign, uncomfortable, awkward, and forced. He is likely to avoid such interactions in one of two ways. He will either isolate himself, finding safety and security in being kind of a loner, or he will gravitate toward female friends. These insecurities about his masculinity are noticed by peers and are deepened even further if he is teased or rejected by other boys, which more than likely will be the case. Girls that are branded as tomboys, well, that generally has no effect. It's even socially acceptable for girls to be rough and tough and athletic. But boys branded as sissies or as a mama's boy, that's a different matter altogether. Then at the onset of puberty, a boy struggling through such feelings of insecurity and rejection from his dad and friends and so on may sexualize his unmet emotional needs. And so, unlike boys who develop heterosexually, his fascination is not directed toward girls. Instead, he is fascinated by that which he doesn't have, in this case, masculinity. At this point in his life, he has already been disconnected from his father, male friends, and his sexuality. His own masculinity is a mystery to him. So while heterosexuals find females intriguing, for they are different, these boys find other boys intriguing. Thus the novel little game, I'll show you mine if you show me yours. Unfortunately, curiosity at this level of sexual experimentation can become a fixation that then becomes a full-fledged homosexual attraction. Psychologists explain that homosexual behavior then among these adolescents and teens is really an attempt to become familiar with their own bodies through other male bodies. Any sexual pleasure the boy experiences strengthens this connection. In turn, homosexual relations become a mainstay for fulfilling their unmet emotional needs for male bonding. And in some situations, homosexual behavior becomes an attempt to exert his failed masculinity. Now, most boys in junior and senior high, they don't want to be homosexuals. Even in our culture, that is very affirming of that lifestyle. Most hope that these feelings they experience is sort of a passing phase. It's hard to say how many do or do not act on those feelings. We would speculate that most likely many just keep all this to themselves and never say anything to anybody about it. Christian boys who might open up to a youth minister are told to simply pray about it or perform other spiritual exercises like scripture memorization or fasting, for instance. And some try dating girls, hoping to remedy those desires. But none of these sorts of things help those who are struggling because their feelings and attractions are not being explained to them, and they are left confused. And unfortunately, many will come to the conclusion that they must be a homosexual. And when they are mocked as a fag or a queer or a homo, they plunge ahead, accepting their lot in life and resign themselves to it. I must be true to myself and quit trying to run from who I really am. And with the availability of gay bars and the internet and even gay churches, a young man will discover a whole world eager to usher him into the homosexual community. There his feelings and desires will be legitimized and affirmed. So there you have it, a kind of abbreviated survey of the child development explanation, at least as it applies to many boys. And it's actually quite sobering and may even hit home to some. Obviously, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of variables that can be added or subtracted from this picture, but the basic gist is the same. For whatever reason, the father-son relationship fails to form and the child feels rejected. And this hinders him from developing a healthy sexual identity, and once he hits puberty, his unmet emotional needs are sexualized. And as you can see in this theory, homosexuality is a manifestation of deeper issues. And these deeper issues are often preventable. Countless homosexual men paint their family portrait as too close to mom, too far from dad. Relationships with their fathers are marked by what is called profound interpersonal disturbance. Again, this unmet emotional need for love and acceptance from the primary male in his life, his father, is, if it continues to be unmet, up to the time of puberty, converted into a sexual desire. The boy will crave what he never had. Now, just to clarify, the issue here is the perception of the child. It may be that the father had no intentions of being distant. Perhaps his job forces him to be away from home. Maybe he's in the military. Maybe there's a divorce and the father is therefore absent. Perhaps he died when the child was very young. Or the dad may legitimately be to blame. He didn't want the kid in the first place, doesn't want to be bothered with having to raise him, would rather spend his time in his own selfish pursuits and that sort of thing. Whatever the case, whether justified or not, the young child interprets the emotional absence of his father as rejection. And this has a profound impact upon the way he processes his own sexual identity. And through homosexual experiences, he attempts to repair unmet, genuine, same-sex emotional needs, attention, affection, and approval from his father and other males. Let me read this account from Alan Chambers, who's actually the current president of Exodus International. So bear with me here. It's quite personal on his part, but I think it will help to sort of flesh out some of these things I've been talking about. Alan Chambers writes, and I got to put on my glasses, sorry. Growing up, I had the equivalent of June Cleaver for a mom, but mine wasn't an actress playing a part. My mom cooked three delicious and nutritious meals a day, made sure our home was the cleanest in town, that her clothes were always fresh and ironed, even her t-shirts. And you could tell that she loved her role, her family, and her life. Mom was a member of the PTA, a frequent chaperone on field trips, a favorite carpool mom, and even my elementary school's crossing guard. She nursed wounds, tucked me in at night, and never failed to express in word and deed how much she treasured and loved her family. My mom was my best friend and my hero. As a child, I saw my dad as a mystery. He was going a lot on business trips, uninvolved in our daily lives and activities, and when he was around, he was the resident disciplinarian, a very strict one. Mom didn't let much pass by the radar, but her discipline was full of patience, life lessons, and some spankings that were always followed up by consolation. Dad, on the other hand, was quick to anger. His bark and bite left me fearful of getting in trouble with him. He was neither fun nor consistent like Mom. From the earliest age, I remember preferring my mom over my dad. I wanted to look like her, act like her, grow up to be just like her. By the time I was six, my favorite thing to do with friends was play house, and I always wanted to be the mom or the sister. Around that age, I also remember copying my mother's habits. For instance, at meals, when she took a bite, I took a bite. When she wiped her mouth with a napkin, I wiped my mouth with a napkin. I walked like her, talked like her, and desperately wanted others to see the striking resemblance. She was the symbol in my life of all that was good, and I thought there was no better goal than to be just like my mom. I remember my mom trying to help me become more boyish. She enrolled me in t-ball and baseball. She asked my brother to teach me to throw a ball and even tried to help me run more like a boy. On the other hand, my dad scolded me for acting like a sissy. Boys at school teased me, and other men in my family just thought I was weird. I couldn't relate to being a boy. All I knew about being one was what I learned from my mom. Well, is this childhood development theory biblical? Well, Scriptures does not claim that homosexuality springs from any of these sorts of factors, nor does it indict parents of homosexuals, or for that matter, suggest any one cause of homosexuality. However, the childhood development theory is logically consistent. It lines up with what we often see in the real world. It is validated by countless testimonies of many homosexual men. It does not contradict biblical teaching, and for these reasons, we could at least say that it is at least compatible with Scripture. But it does have some limitations. For instance, not every boy whose father has failed to connect with him will grow up to be a homosexual. And there are a number of homosexuals who did have a wholesome relationship with their fathers from infancy all the way to adulthood, and so there must be another explanation for those situations. The child development theory can be quite helpful in explaining these desires of many boys, but probably doesn't offer that much help when it comes to girls. Some, but perhaps not quite as much. We would have to conclude, therefore, that the theory does offer a valid explanation for many cases. It's accurate, it's helpful, but in the end, it doesn't provide a one-size-fits-all explanation. And so it must be seen as one of several explanations. But there's a lot to it, and it is certainly compatible with Scripture. And like the born this way theory, in the end, the child development theory doesn't justify homosexual behavior either. We need to be very clear about this. We may have sympathy for why the person struggles with these desires, and we should have sympathy. But again, every person is responsible before God to restrain himself and not indulge in what God has prohibited. Well, I think you can see the sobering application here. Because, if you're a dad, it's pretty obvious here, the importance of connecting with your kids. It is quite disheartening to see fathers relate to their own children as though they are a nuisance rather than the blessing that the Bible calls them. You know, you need to play with them. You need to engage in conversations with them. You need to roughhouse with them. You need to get involved in their lives. You need to encourage and affirm them. Guide them, protect them, interact with them constantly, have fun with them, and never, 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 regardless of the circumstance, ever call them a sissy or otherwise imply that their masculinity is deficient or questionable or incomplete. Never belittle them. You know, if they are not athletic or manly in the traditional sense, then don't force it. Don't make them be what you want them to be, because they will pick up on your disappointment and frustration. And so you don't want to risk any rejection issues here. Find out what they are interested in and enter into that world with them. So much could be said here. And this is why dads should not be, over the top in their disciplining, and why moms need to take their turns as well at this. And it actually kind of makes me wonder if there isn't more to the biblical command, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, than what meets the eye. There's probably a lot behind that we haven't really appreciated. So in some ways, today's sermon would actually make an ideal Father's Day message. It's not all that uncommon for dads to be aloof and detached, or on the other side of the spectrum, to be harsh and abusive. And it's not all that uncommon for children to feel detached, even rejected, especially sons. And ironically, this is so ironic, Such dads who oftentimes despise homosexuals themselves are creating them in their own home and don't even realize it. All right, this is something stepfathers in particular need to be alert to and work extra hard at in connecting with their stepsons. They may not be able to take the place of their biological dads, but they can at least provide a sound, responsible, gentle, masculine, affirming, and affectionate relationship with them nonetheless. All right, next week we will continue on looking at some other explanations for homosexual desires. We have a few more to add to this list here. And again, let me just encourage you, if you've missed any of the previous sermons, please go to the website and get caught up. So at this time, let's go ahead and have the children come in. I'm sorry, I forgot to ring the bell. I'll ring it now. Way too late. And let's stand, and we'll have the musicians come forward, and we'll continue our service.